Welcome back to another edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Thursday, July 9th. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined by Irish Illustrated's Drew Mentock and John Bryce of USA Today. Where is John Bryce on your screen? Only the shadow knows, but JB is here. He will be speaking to us shortly. Fresh off a trip to the Big 12 Media Days. We'll get to that a little bit later. Could be a important recruiting weekend, guys. Four-star linebacker Roman Igwebuike is set to announce, I believe, after 4 o'clock on Saturday. Tim Priester wrote an article today talking about the hay is almost in the barn for 2027. Obviously, some things will happen between now and early signing day, but it's Igwebuike and four-star defensive tackle within the Chicago area, Braden Parks, down to Notre Dame and Oregon. We've talked about Igwebuike in the past, but considering two linebacker decommits, Drew Mentock, it would be important, I think, to get Igwebuike at this part. Notre Dame could suffer NFL attrition at the position, or they could get convince a couple guys to come back as well.
Yeah, definitely. And just building for the future, too. You don't want a class that doesn't have a linebacker, even if it's de-emphasized compared to where it was a decade ago. But they also didn't get Henderson, too, even though that seemed like that was going to happen. So he's still a, you know, a top 247 prospect. Roman Igwebuike is. And he's a Chicago area kid, too. So getting him full run show, we'll see what happens with Parks, as you mentioned. But kind of reestablishing that pipeline where you're getting the top kids from Chicago to come to Notre Dame would also be big. But yeah, I think he's a good prospect. They can't completely miss at this position. And it, you know, Brian Jean-Marie kind of came into a maybe precarious position a little bit with multiple linebacker coaches in the course of a few months and having to redo the board. But if he can at least get one high-end prospect, and then they can kind of figure things out going forward and potentially even go into the transfer portal if necessary. But at least getting somebody in this class is important.
Maybe. Yeah, and go ahead, JB.
Just quickly, I was going to say it's important big picture because Notre Dame is still up there in the national consensus class rankings. And so if they can close on a couple of these high-profile guys down the stretch, it keeps them right there neck and neck with Texas A&M's class. There's some components of Notre Dame's class that I think are the best in the country, particularly in the trenches. Texas A&M maybe has a little more top-end star power in its class.
Interesting note on linebackers in the portal. It's one of the positions Notre Dame has never gone into the portal for a transfer linebacker. I would assume if they get back Jaden Osbury because his NIL could be worth more than his draft status would be, they could possibly avoid that as long as they like Ko'o'kia as much as we think they do and Madden Framo comes back. And we don't know about Clapper and Thomas Davis's. They have 15 months to get better at linebacker, but probably you're going to have to see something in the next 6 months from one of those guys to avoid the portal. But I mean, if you get Osbury back, you could get a portal helper as opposed to a portal highlight at linebacker.
Well, it is interesting, too, with Luke Talich now potentially being able to come back with 5-for-5, and we know he's playing that hybrid linebacker role, too. So not necessarily that I say he'll switch to linebacker next year, but that KVA role that kind of has him all over the field. But you at least have a guy who maybe plays another position technically, but still can help fill some of those snaps and still be productive there at his size at 6'4", 225 pounds.
Irish, not newly in on 7th-ranked quarterback in the 2028 class, Lucas Prock from the Hunt School in New Jersey, but he is down to Ohio State, Notre Dame, and IU. I believe he's made 3 visits to Notre Dame's campus already. JB, I know I wanted to talk to you a little bit. I don't think you've been on since the Trey Tagliaferri decommit. I, for one, and this doesn't really matter because we're looking at kids in the middle of their high school careers, but I, for one, like Lucas Prock more than Tagliaferri anyway. I did mention that on the podcast, so that's not secondhand. I think you felt the same way as well.
I did, yeah. No, not revisionist history here, just as you studied the two. Prock was one that I had up there alongside Prayer when they were deep with him.
He was the highest on mine, yeah.
Prayer. Yeah, Tagliaferri was an interesting one. He committed to Notre Dame, I think, on Father's Day during that visit because his dad is such a Notre Dame fan, but apparently his heart wasn't in it as much, according to what I was told. And he had favored Oklahoma for a bit. I don't know. Somebody mentioned Baker Mayfield. I don't know if that's exactly what it was, but I do think that, like, he was a little conflicted when he gave his commitment to Notre Dame. He himself had preferred Oklahoma, and then certainly Oklahoma, like Notre Dame, is aggressively spending right now. And so I think Oklahoma, coupled with the fact that it offered more money and probably a more clear path to a playing time sooner rather than later, were all factors in that. But no, I do. I like, and the Hun School has had some great players through the years, as we all know. So I kind of like Proc in that regard. And it's 2028 quarterback. Notre Dame's quarterback room is full, as we've well discussed, after it was much like the wide receiver room and bereft of talent for a bit. So this is years down the road problems, and who knows what college football itself will even look like by then.
This goes a little bit to my point on Monday too, but this is the good part about Tagliaferri decommitting so quickly, is that now you have the chance to get in on somebody else. And this, if this has happened 3 months from now, Proc might already be gone, things like that too. So this, as weird as it was, it's still good that it happened so quickly. And now you're about to get a guy according to the composite, or to have a chance to get a guy according to the composite, who's the number 69 overall player in the country, I think number 6 quarterback. Also another New Jersey kid, so you could potentially upgrade New Jersey signal caller commits to in the process.
At some point, today is not that point, I will get used to seeing IU sandwiched between Ohio State and Notre Dame when it comes to a top commit. I'm not there yet, but it's getting a little bit closer to that moment. I am used to Shamrock series, the unveiling. I rarely watch them. I did not see this one, but we do have some coverage of Notre Dame's new Shamrock series jerseys to be not unveiled, but they unveiled them this week, and Notre Dame will have blue and gold with a homage to the Green Bay Packers. Drew, you explain that, please.
I don't fully know the history, but it sounds like from the video Notre Dame released that the Packers used to wear those similar colors. So it was a way to kind of ignite two historic football programs, one professional, obviously, and then Notre Dame in college. So just kind of an ode to the history with Notre Dame playing in Lambeau. And I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, you're playing Wisconsin, so you're trying to steal some of that Packers connection, fandom thunder too. So it'll be interesting, but they look similar. I think Bryce actually noted this in our group thread, that they look similar to the ones 2 years ago when they played Army with the blue-gray sky homage to Grantland Rice. So kind of comparable, but I don't get super into the jersey thing, but I know the players like them. I'm sure it does well at the bookstore and things like that too. So it's definitely worth talking about, but I don't have strong opinions on jerseys.
Yeah, I like the Zweller. TZ did a really good job on just chronicling all the uniforms in the Shamrock series. And I like the 2013 all whites that were trimmed. The gold numbers were trimmed in green. Those are some of my favorites. And then I love the 2024 edition that did pay homage to the Four Horsemen and Grantland Rice. They were just, as Drew knows, they were freaking impossible, and O'Malley as well, to see the numbers in Yankee Stadium that night. And it was bad for everybody. And so we'll see. These look fine. We know Notre Dame going to be playing at 6:30 Central in that contest. So we'll see how the numbers look under the lights. But yeah, the 2013s and the 2024s, for those who chronicle such things and for those who track such things, those are probably my two favorite iterations in those. The uniforms themselves, the helmets, I don't know. There's a couple of different ones there. So
2013s were sweet. I'll give it there. Notre Dame in white with the gold lettering, gold, obviously the gold helmets. It's funny, Judge Arthur Vandal, I asked, where do the newest Shamrock Series uniform rank for you? I will need to see it on the field first, Arthur Vandalay, and I will need to see if I can read the numbers, because that's number one for the spoiled media. Nobody cares if the media likes the jerseys, by the way. It's all about the players and the fans, of course. But my answer is, from what was the best, what was the worst, or do you just not care? I do not care. However, I have grown to like the Lightning Rod jersey from 2018 in Yankee Stadium.
Oh.
I know, Drew Menchok can't believe it. It doesn't look like Notre Dame at all, but if you're divergent for one day, it's fine. I have grown to like those. I know they're not the best ones, but maybe I just like how mad everybody got at them too.
I was going to rank those last. Yeah.
I know everybody thinks that. Yes.
with your quixotic persona, I'm stunned that you would delve into that brouhaha, O'Malley.
The non-gold helmet. The helmet, I know the helmet makes, the helmet looks cool. We often do Augie's locker room incident analysis, Drew. The helmet he has there, when you just look at it separately, is a really cool helmet. I can see how it could affect Notre Dame fans' delicate sensibilities, though, because it certainly is. It's not the traditional look.
Well, it's all, so Notre Dame just has the coolest helmet in general. That's the one part I feel like you don't need to screw with. Like, it looks great always. I don't know.
Yeah, I enjoy being part of the 1% in this. JB is back home after visiting Big 12 Media Days. You've also sat down, had some one-on-ones. JB out there in hometown in Provo, pretty important for the Notre Dame's upcoming football season. I wanted to ask you a couple things about your takeaways from Big 12 Media Day, but let's start with the most important because it affects Notre Dame and everybody else. Week zero, about to become the norm in college football, and it was highlighted there at Big 12.
Yeah, so starting in 2027, and we've broached that subject here on the pod before, but starting in 2027, the NCAA's passed measure that allows every team to begin scheduling week zero games. You don't have to get a special waiver. You don't have to have a special reason. It's just the calendar basically is moving up a week, even if they're calling it week zero, to keep from saying week one is moving up a week. So many teams are going to begin playing in late August next year. I think the Big 12, particularly in visiting, I visited one-on-one with 14 of the 16 head coaches down there this week, and the Big 12 is leaning into it definitely. Many of those guys want to try and get that first week zero game in for any number of reasons, but specifically to get two open dates over the balance of the calendar, and also maybe especially coaches want a later season open date to prepare for a hoped for longer playoff run. I think news will be coming very soon on multiple Big 12 teams who are going to announce that they're playing week zero games in 2027. I would expect Notre Dame to follow suit with that, especially the way that Notre Dame travels around the country. So that was probably most interesting to me. I'll have some more stuff there. One of the coaches pitched to me making the bowl games week zero and even incorporating NIL, almost making it like the players' tournament in college basketball and doing it in football, because everyone's going to be playing week zero anyway. So why not make it the bowl games, get the matchups? If you expand to 24, you have less teams scared to play premier matchups in those week zero teams. So I found that pretty interesting that more and more coaches are wanting to maybe look at a way to replicate the players tournament in men's college basketball and find a way to drive revenue and NIL figures in that regard. And the bowls were there. A number of bowl representatives at Big 12 Media Days there at Dallas Cowboys headquarters in Frisco. And they're certainly panicking for their futures, especially if they're not part of the CFP.
Now, that makes a lot of sense, especially if, I mean, they're, even when they do get games, they're having teams opt out right now. They're having players not play. Like, if you can get some of that star power, and maybe it's not what they're used to, but I think that makes a lot of sense. And it, I think especially if they do go to 24 teams, having that second bye is going to be really important. Like, you could be playing a long season to get that extra time off. And we've saw Notre Dame have that recently, where I think that extra bye weekend goes a long way. And I also appreciate it too.
You know, number one, I'm just jealous I didn't think about that idea, because that's a great idea to play the bowl games for week zero. You could also have bowl week for all the host sites. I know it might not be quite the same festivities as like the Christmas presents were, was what that became, of course, the time of the year. But you could certainly, if you convince the teams to travel there Tuesday, just start. It doesn't have to be over a week. I mean, what if they just traveled there Monday night and they had their whole bowl week in those towns? Logistically, obviously, you need high schools to practice at, which is always open in December. When you think about it, those high schools aren't practicing when you're out in Arizona. I love that idea, because it also would bring back the value of the bowl. There's no way these bowls think it's okay that 15 of the 20 best players on these teams aren't playing in their bowls, and that certainly would not happen in week one. And JB, I think that would make the 24-team tournament, which both you and I think is 8 too many, and make it worth it for me if I got to see one great week of football to start the year. And it's not like it's, you're not supposed to lose, but it's not punitive in that it knocks you out of anything if you're going to be having 24 teams in there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to write about it. The coach in question is Morgan Scalley, but then talk to some of his peers there in the Big 12, and there were multiple that were on board with it, especially from a NIL revenue driver standpoint to help get the players more money. I think that's key. One other note of interest coming out of Big 12 Media Days that pertains directly to Notre Dame, continued to have it indicated to me, again, this is likely, it's believed likely, it's not official by any stretch, but the Big 12 expects that Notre Dame BYU will kick off at 3:30 p.m. Eastern on October 17th, 1:30 Mountain Time. And they just said they believe, in talking with television executives, that they want the pull of Notre Dame BYU in the middle of the game to bridge the noon games into the night games, because the primetime game that night on the national scope is almost certain to be Indiana-Ohio State. And I can't imagine that won't be. But you also have Penn State, Michigan, that night. You also have Florida State, Miami that day. You have obviously BYU, Notre Dame. You have Florida, Texas, Alabama, Tennessee, and you also have Auburn, Georgia. So in talking with them, they believe that TV executives will jostle to have Notre Dame, BYU in that 3:30 window because those two teams will draw, especially Notre Dame, will draw extra eyeballs maybe from an ending SEC broadcast before the next SEC night game or what have you. So, again, not official, but that's the third time that I've been told that it's trending toward a 3:30 Eastern kickoff.
I am officially excited about week zero being bowl week. That would be absolutely fantastic for the sport right now. And John Bryce, I appreciate you breaking the news officially that Notre Dame will play Ohio State in the 2028 Rose Bowl open season on our Iron Bowl Insider podcast. Thank you very much for that.
Just for you, O'Malley. Thanks for you.
We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question comes from Scrap of Coco, and he has been asking for a while. He even references that. I'm going to keep bothering you until you answer my question. Where is the basketball NIL money? Why do we have to go all in on football but ignore basketball? It makes zero sense. First of all, that's going to be our first topic of discussion. Where is the NIL money many other schools are getting while giving most revenue share to football? I promised him we would answer this question, and here we go, JB.
That's a very valid and fair question. I will say that for eons of college athletics existence, Notre Dame has prioritized football over anything else and has always devoted more resources to football than anything else. I think that that's no different here. You can say, where is the money when how it's divided and all that. There's still finite dollars. Like, Notre Dame is spending almost as much as anyone in the country on college football. That's been hammered home to me over the course of summer at a number of different events that I've covered and attended. But basketball, but also I would point out Pete Bavakwa is on Notre Dame on Capitol Hill regularly and maybe there again next week, if I'm not mistaken, supporting the Protect College Sports Act while saying there's not a salary cap in college football right now. But Notre Dame wants to do everything it can to keep the traditional college athletics model in play. And that doesn't mean that Notre Dame doesn't want to see its student athletes earn money. Notre Dame is very pro real NIL. It's also, I think, had a crossroads moment where it said, if we don't go full tilt into the college football arms race in its present iteration, we're going to lose Marcus Freeman to the NFL, and we're going to set back more than just Notre Dame football. You set back any number of things, and money is finite. So I think it's that. I think basketball also has to show that it's worth investing in. So sometimes you have to prove that you can do more with less in order to get more. We haven't seen that out of men's basketball. And that to me, that's how it's been explained to me. That's a super fair question. I don't disagree with Scrap of Coco being frustrated with it. But if you've got 40 plus million invested in football, from wherever those dollars are coming from, you still only have finite dollars. We've been told, I know Pete Bavakwa told a gathering of people on campus that basketball would have a $6 million roster this year. You know, that's a lot more than it was last year. That's still way behind the $18 and $20 million rosters. As a football coach told me literally yesterday, we have too many $40 million rosters out there playing against $15 million rosters. And Notre Dame basketball is going to be, by all accounts, a $6 million roster playing against a lot of $18 million rosters.
Yeah, I think the point you made about, like, I mean, Notre Dame, why are they going to retain some of the guys that left when they still went 13 and 18 last year? Like, I think if NIL became allowed after the 2016 season, maybe we're having a different conversation. Maybe there's more reason to invest. But Notre Dame putting that kind of capital behind a program that hasn't shown it can be successful with it is just going to be hard to do when football is pushing towards that national championship too. Like you mentioned, the Marcus Freeman, like that program is ascending. Why are they going to put extra money in a program that is underachieving? I think is probably where their head is at right now.
It has lost the attention of the fan base largely, and not just when Micah Shrewsbury joined. It started waning in the last 4 years of the Bray era, came back briefly for 1 year. I don't know if it captured the attention of the fan base as much when they made their when they won two NCAA tournament games and almost got to the Sweet 16. But it was a good basketball team. it's a rough spot for Notre Dame. I like to remind people that good basketball team that went 15-5 in the ACC was the last team in. They were the 68th team to make the NCAA tournament. And at that point, Mike Bray realized we're in trouble in the future. 15-5 in the ACC, we're the last team in the NCAA tournament. They had to play the play-in game, of course, against Rutgers. It's just a tough spot for Notre Dame men's basketball here, but I appreciate the persistence on the question, Scrapper Coco. Next one, Irish Morgue. With the summer program in full swing, has there been changes to the limitations placed on contact between the coaches and players? Can you guys lend any insight into how much the expanded staff, such as analysts or grad assistants, can be involved with players during this time?
The NCAA still has its standard guidelines. There's proposals to change that as soon as next year, when everyone I've talked to and reading the NCAA proposal indicate that it would become a much more OTA-like, NFL-like calendar from spring ball all the way through summer. I forget, I think it might be 8 hours a week right now that coaches are officially allowed to spend with the players during summer. But PLPs are the mode of existence, and that's player-led practices. Now, look, those player-led practices are oftentimes coming with script from the coaches, and there's a lot of coach evaluation of those events probably after they've taken place. But strictly by the letter of the rules for this question, the dramatic changes are expected to occur next year as long as those new latest NCAA proposals pass. I know Drew saw those proposals as well. We talked about it on our shared group text message. So that's the best way I can answer that, is like, it's still extremely player led in the summers, but it was just a few years ago the NCAA voted to allow, I'm pretty sure it's 8 hours. I'll try to double check that, certainly before next Thursday. So that's that. PLPs, like PFP is the popular term in Major League Baseball, pitcher fielding practice, and PLP is the college buzzword for player-led practices in the summer.
Yeah, we know too, like, I mean, maybe not right now, but having like Codlin is the safeties coach, like he's still probably technically an analyst, but there can be a lot more involved with recruiting and on the field stuff now too in general. And yeah, I believe that proposal, I'd have to double check, but it allowed for like 20 to 25 spring practices and then maybe starting fall camp a little earlier, but spreading it out. So maybe getting more work in, but over a longer period of time. So it's still potentially better for the student athlete. But as John mentioned, that hasn't been approved yet, but I know it's something they brought up at the NCAA recently.
Yeah, they could never go more than like in the off season, you couldn't go more than five consecutive weeks or something like that ever at any point. Like, again, there's more built in protections for the players to protect their schedules as well as their bodies. I think that's a big thing. It's another indicator, frankly, that, you know, collective bargaining is on the horizon, probably in some form or fashion.
Maybe I have a question for you with Codlin. He's the safeties coach, but that kind of gives them one extra coach. Would it have been better if he was considered an analyst?
I don't think so, because the NCAA changed that rule a couple of years ago as well and just basically said now that coaches and analysts and whomever can work with players on the field. It used to be, I mean, I think Notre Dame at some point in the last decade maybe even self-reported a secondary NCAA violation because an analyst was coaching on the field. Well, that's not an issue anymore. The NCAA finally just did away with that. And again, like we treat the NCAA like a monolithic organization. The NCAA is its member organizations, member institutions. So when I say the NCAA did away with it, their oversight committee made up of university and college representatives voted to do away with it.
So and that's a great idea, because they do definitely should be coaching on the field. Nowadays, analysts are very good ex-college football or current college football coaches. I think the analyst thing when it started was almost in the grad assistant realm, but it's just, that's 10 years ago.
It was that, yeah, that's the analyst is added to our lexicon thanks to Nick Saban. He was the first to go out and hire, I want to say like Mike Groh or somebody like that from Virginia, somebody who had been an offensive coordinator and was deep into a professional career. And he basically invented a new position. And then everybody realized that they had to have it. And then, you know, when Billy Napier got to Florida, he famously had like a staff of 150 people. Like they have a team photo where there are more people in polo shirts than in football jerseys.
And I think those type of rules too are ultimately there so they wouldn't, I guess, contribute to the arms race and what the wealthier programs could kind of have a competitive advantage. But ultimately, I think it's better for the development of the football players that you can have more people specializing in what they're teaching them. And we even saw this year where I think it was Coach Boo was, you know, coaching the Nichols and taking them aside specifically and stuff too. So I think it probably does enhance the student athlete development, which I think is ultimately what's most important.
You can't see me, Drew, but I'm pointing at the screen, like giving you a thumbs up. So you hit the nail on the head right there. It was done that way to try and thwart overspending and keep some semblance of this. I don't want to say fiscal sanity because that left a long time ago, but to keep some sort of guardrails. But now, as we know, like especially as it pertains to college football, there are no guardrails anywhere.
Knowing JB, the thumb is not the finger he had up for you, Drew, but I digress.
Our next question is from Irish Carbomb. Where does the upside of Lambert and Black put them against former Notre Dame tackles?
It's a great question because Lambert is a second-year player moving positions, or excuse me, third-year player moving positions after 1 year. Black, straight-up redshirt freshman. So I try to go back and make it. It's never going to be apples to apples, but in 2022, you had breakout 2021 freshman Joe Alt at left tackle and the guy that only got to play 1.5 games, Blake Fisher, at right tackle. That's got to be the highest upside. I know Alt was more well-known, but he played about as many. Lambert played more than Alt did going into this year, if you're going to compare them. But Alt Fisher is the biggest upside I can think of going into a year for tackles. At one point, Eichenberg and Hainsey. Hainsey was a second-year starter. Eichenberg was a first-year starter, but third-year player. That was pretty good, and that was the 18 team that went 12-1. Then I thought of, probably not as fair, but Ronnie Stanley in his second year as a player in 14, and McGlinchey as a redshirt freshman. Though McGlinchey didn't get his chance till later. That was Christian Lombard, who was starting there, then he ended up with a bad back. But upside, Alton Fisher, that's the upside, right? You can't. It's hard to argue against those two.
Yeah.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, Drew, you asked the question. I'm supposed to get to answer before you.
My apologies.
Put the Tour de France jersey back on and fall back in the pack. You know, I read this question a little bit differently. I took it as not necessarily paired together, just where does their upside stack up against some of the great Notre Dame tackles that we've seen in the last couple of decades. And I'm not bullish at all on Will Black. I've heard too many great things about him for 3 years now that I think, and because of the body frame and the body types, that the Joe Alt comparisons are both natural and at this point unavoidable. But I'm so ridiculously bullish on Gerby Lambert, and I think he is a rich man's Emil Wagner. And Emil Wagner played about as many snaps as any right tackle anywhere in college football the last couple of years, and did so effectively, but in my opinion, never dominantly. And I think Gerby Lambert has dominant potential round one upside to him. I have not remotely seen enough out of Will Black to say he has potential Joe Alt upside from a top six draft position. But I know the excitement level that Notre Dame has had about him forever. I still remember Caleb Davis and Chad Bowden and those guys telling me he was the number one tackle on their board when a lot of college football didn't know about him. And I know how creative Notre Dame has been to make sure that it's able to recruit guys with Canadian roots, Canadian natives, and make sure that they're still able to participate in rev share and NIL and all of that. So it's a long way of answering. I love the upside of it. I understand the Fisher Alt is the natural comparison if you're looking at them as a pairing, but I just am just supremely bullish on Gerby Lambert.
Yeah, I mean, with Will Black, I always remember on his high school tape him taking a screen pass 50 yards for a touchdown. And I know he played high school in Connecticut, but he's definitely a guy who's super talented. I mean, I think Joe Alt is one of the most talented tackles to come out in a generation. I think he went fifth overall in the Chargers. He probably goes higher in like the draft 2 years ago. I think he's just an excellent talent. So they're probably not quite that high, but I think both could exceed like certainly where Blake Fisher went in terms of potential. Like I think they're both huge. I mean, both are 6'7". I think Black's listed at 316, Lambert's 325, which I think even with him coming out of high school, he was a like top 50 player, but he was only around 280. So he's put on 45 pounds or so at Notre Dame and still maintain that soccer agility that he had, which I feel like we have a lot more soccer in the brain right now. So you can kind of see where that footwork and things like that come up. So I think they're both, you know, day two for sure, maybe first round potential. I think they have a high ceiling on both regard, but both are young. Both, I mean, Black has hardly any experience, so we're going to see a lot more from him this year. And we did see even Rodney Dunham beat him pretty good in practice a few times this spring. So there's definitely some development there, but I think from a purely physical athleticism talent standpoint, he's got a high ceiling.
I think Lambert could be better right tackle at Notre Dame than Blake Fisher was at Notre Dame as well. If you're going by preseason publicity, I mean, Blake Fisher was off the charts when he was coming back that year, but I think Lambert could be better on the field. Black is the number one reason we need to see things like practice number five in an August camp. Otherwise, we're still going back to Drew's reference about high school film and spring stuff, because we have to see him in pads go again for three periods. We just got to see Will Black in pads in August go against Boubacar Traore, Rodney Dunham, Keon Keeley. You just got to see that a little to be able to form your own opinion. We've seen Kirby Lambert play ball already.
Question number four from good friend of the program, Terry Benedict. If you're Mike Martin, do you encourage Marcus Freeman to keep some of the younger talent, quote, in the barn, so that you don't have to pay them more in the off season? Tim O'Malley, fill your rummer full of a Cadillac margarita and answer first.
Water in a old, very old hydro flask right here.
Nobody believes you.
Yes.
Nobody believes you.
Nobody really knows, right? It's noon something.
Vino. So, that's Vino.
Yeah. Hey, it's a great question by Terry Benedict, because I don't think, you know, Mike Martin's encouraging Marcus Freeman in September to not get that third string really, really good freshman out there, because that third string guy can leave immediately for more NIL. He'll know how good he is. It's a interesting dynamic when you're, and I'm not even talking about like, I mean, no way talking about 2Bs. I'm talking about straight up number threes, right? Where you could actually reasonably not have them on the field. There's two ways of looking at it. Yeah, you can save a little NIL money. I think if you don't play a guy now and you think they should, they're gone for a higher NIL contract. Jadon Blair is my example. I don't think Notre Dame was dying to play him, but there was no chance he was coming back when he was not on the field much at the end of that year and Ethan Long was. So I think it's a really hard choice that Martin and Freeman have to make in November when you're preparing for the playoff, most importantly, making your roster better. But knowing that you don't want to lose this guy necessarily to, hey, we're planning on paying you $200,000. Let's pretend Mark Zachary was just great last year instead of good. Let's say he was fantastic. So in a games against Syracuse that are completely out of control, you're winning by 70 points. Zachary picks off two balls for touchdowns like Jalen Stroman did. That hurts when you want to give Mark Zachary, the backup, the same amount of NIL you were giving him as a freshman, Mark Zachary, the backup. So I'll turn it over to you guys, but I just think Martin and Freeman and everybody else like them has tough conversations when you have a deep roster, because you also are going to lose guys if you don't play them.
Yeah, and I think this speaks to, I mean, Mark Sherman says, like, you have to have those conversations early and be talking to them constantly. When we're talking about, in November, are you worried about certain people leaving? They're like, we're having those conversations early. It's not going to be a surprise. So I think gauging what those players need, and I think sometimes you want to sell developmental opportunities too, even if they could go get a better offer elsewhere. It's like, look, we put you in, we're investing in you, you're going to get on the field in the future and then get that pay bump. So I think that's probably discussions, and it's going to be harder to not play certain freshmen now that the 5-for-5 rule has passed too, because there's no, well, we want to redshirt you and give you that extra year. Like, that justification is out the window, and I'm sure Marty Biagi is going to want to get certain guys involved in special teams and stuff, because there's no reason to hold them back. So I think ultimately it probably would err on the side of maybe it's late in the year and be like, hey, we don't need to put this guy in or whatever. But I would doubt encouraging it is not how I'd put it from what I would think Mike Martin would do.
You once again are on the money there, Drew, with the 5-for-5 component. That was hammered home to me by Big 12 coaches this week. I mean, time and again, and specific to the quarterback position, I had a number of them tell me, even in off the record conversations, like, this is going to change the quarterback position, because you're not going to worry about a guy's redshirt year anymore. If your junior starter is just middling along in the middle of the season and your freshman is super talented, you're way more likely to turn to that kid in game 6 or 7 than you ever would have been before. So I found that very interesting. I asked all seven coaches that I visited with yesterday about how they try to allocate the resources on their roster from a financial and a strategic standpoint. in terms of how much, what percentage of their payroll is devoted to their top 40 players versus their back 50 players, because they can't ignore the back 50. They've got to be getting quality looks in practice and on the practice field. And one coach, I'll find it, and I'll certainly be writing it in the coming weeks at USA Today. But one coach told me he absolutely, it's Colin Klein at Kansas State, the almost Notre Dame offensive coordinator. He absolutely hates the 105-man roster limit. He is pushing for it to go back to 120 to 125. He said he's got friends he played with at Kansas State that came as walk-ons that ended up in the NFL. He thinks that it's depriving a number of guys who love college football for probably all the reasons we love college football, in that we were never, ever going to be good enough to play it, that have found their way to help a team and help a program. So that was very interesting. But a lot of those guys made it clear they try to heavily invest in the top 40 of their roster, the top 45 players of the roster. Those are the guys they spend on. Those are the guys they play. But they do believe the 5-for-5 is getting ready to usher in a whole new era of freshman playing, and specific to the quarterback position.
You also can't lie to people with the 5-for-5. Marcus Freeman's very upfront with painfully honest conversations, I know, with the third string guys and the second string guys, and Mike Martin has to be. But you used to be able to say, we're preserving a redshirt year. We want to talk you into preserving a redshirt year. It's much better for you if you don't play. And some guys, sometimes that's true and sometimes that's not across college football. There's no redshirt year to preserve. There's nothing to tell somebody that, hey, now we're not going to play. You're better off not playing. You're not better off. You're never better off not playing in 5-for-5. You're always better getting out there and getting your feet wet now. I mean, from your own point of view as an athlete. Next question from Maltese Irish. He had two good ones this week, Maltese Irish. I had to cut one of them, though, for our unwritten rules. What can you tell us about what Notre Dame had and lost in Jordan Blake and his former role, which was director of recruiting logistics? What does that entail, as well as any buzz about a potential replacement? JB, I'm going to turn it over to you because you and I had this conversation in January. Director of recruiting logistics was not his role last year at Notre Dame.
Yeah, there was a reorg, and Jordan sort of got lost in the shuffle of that reorg. They brought in the two guys from Penn State. I continue to hear really good things about them. Carter Almond continues to be a linchpin in that office. The young kid, Justice, his last name escapes me. I'll try to find it here. I've referenced him on the pod before as being critical. Justice Bathis as being a critical young guy that Mike Martin identified, put to work in the office in a part-time role, and has just really become one of those guys who will do anything at all to help Notre Dame recruiting in anything he can, whether it's driving a golf cart across campus or hosting a visit in a family or making travel plans for the coaches. He will do anything and everything he can to help the program. So there hasn't been a lot of buzz. I asked around last weekend about that over the holiday weekend when I was around some folks. There wasn't a lot of talk about it. I don't think it's the number one priority for Notre Dame right now to fill that spot, because they like what they're doing. They're recruiting at a really high level. And, you know, they may look at how they reallocate those funds. Maybe it's raises for people. That department has grown exponentially from the time Chad Bowden arrived as a defensive recruiting coordinator or whatever it was for Marcus Freeman to where it stands today. So it's still vastly larger than it was even just 2 to 3 years ago.
Is it something, director of recruiting logistics, did that become something for Blake that was just on campus? Maybe. I mean, is it literally as the words read it off from your understanding?
Yeah.
That's, then I think it's probably a replaceable role at this point for, but that's, he went out to, and by the way, he did go to the NFL, Las Vegas Raiders. So that's a nice boost for Jordan.
You never regret Notre Dame on your resume.
No, you do not.
Our next question is from CMU Pens fan. If CJ Carr is the number one player Notre Dame needs to have healthy, who is number two?
Go ahead, JB.
I kind of lean Drake Bowen.
And he wasn't healthy in the spring, so you're making everybody upset right now. There's no.
Yeah. Also,
is that because Kingston's hurt right now?
Yeah, it is. But Osbury can run the defense, mm-hmm. So maybe that's a real crap answer by me. Maybe I wanted to say Ashton Craig. How many bad snaps did we see in spring?
Several.
Yeah, that's true. I can't remember.
Kind of take that for granted.
Beyond Ottawa, yeah. But you're right.
Yeah. So frankly, I've got beyond CJ Carr, I'm looking at a combination of like Ashton Craig and your Mike Backer. And look, that doesn't mean your Mike Backer is your best player on your defense, but I just think that's your green dot. So you're telling me your green dot's not important to have your number one green dot healthy going into the season?
I talked myself into one here because I think we have wide receiver question later, so I'll save a lot of my commentary. I think Jordan Faison would be pretty bad to lose. It drops the confidence I have, not the talent level. If you lose Leonard Moore, your talent level drops amazingly in the secondary, but you still have other guys. I think losing Jordan Faison would really hurt the wide receiver room. That's the constant. That's the guy you have, you know about, that we think Mylon Graham will become, that Jaden Greathouse has been in three games of his life. He brings a captain attitude to everything, too, and special teams. He's the go-to guy. So I think it would be really bad if they lost Faison.
I agree. Faison was one of my answers. I mean, and he's like the ideal guy for like 3rd and 7, too, where you can just toss it out to him 4 yards and he go gets it. That's invaluable. It's maybe cheating or low-hanging fruit, but I'm still going with Leonard Moore. I know the secondary is going to be great regardless, but to have the best cornerback in the country, a guy who can take away the other team's best wide receiver, Notre Dame is going to play, see at least Malachi Toney. Maybe he'll be matched up with him, but even if you want see Jeremiah Smith or certain guys like that in the playoffs, like that is the type of player you need on those guys. And I think wide receiver play is really significant once you get into the playoffs, and we'll see where Notre Dame is in that regard. But having that lockdown cornerback, having, you know, by far in the way, I think the most talented, other than maybe KVA once he's back, the most talented player on the defense at role that can erase half the field is huge. And then really sets up the rest of that secondary to be successful too.
I'd definitely rather lose Faison for the Miami game than Leonard Moore. If you're really getting super specific here, Leonard Moore would be the guy I wanted that game more than anything else. I just wonder, with so many, there's so much talent at corner now. I mean, even a guy like Kerry Adams, if he was healthy all spring, I think we'd be talking about him, as Drew, you've mentioned recently, a guy that could be playing. I just remember Benjamin Morrison going down and Leonard Moore taking over being better. So I'm not sure I can say the corner. What would happen if they lost Tate Johnson? I think that's a lot of playmaking ability in the secondary, because I don't think Luke Talich plays like Tate Johnson. I don't think you just say, well, Talich is your best backup anyway. He's not Tate Johnson in the secondary. He's a much different football player than Johnson. I think that would really hurt Notre Dame as well. The one thing I've learned about these indispensable lists, though, every time I do one, they're completely invalid because the guys get hurt and Notre Dame overcomes them. It's really just the attrition of too many injuries that eventually knocks a team out.
Yeah, and Tate Johnson is certainly the more dynamic playmaker. Luke Talich, arguably the more versatile player for Notre Dame, because you can do different things with him. You can put him in that alley. So,
and I like him being in that versatile spot rather than just playing safety.
Correct, right. Correct. Yeah. Question number 7, Irish from A2. I want to know what A2 means. If the 2026 season is below expectations, what will be the main reasons and storyline? Obviously, excluding major injuries. T.O., I always go first to you, mixing it up. Drew, the floor is yours.
I mean, I think there are a couple things. I think one would be C.J. Carr doesn't become that obvious first-round pick, top 10 draft pick kind of guy. Like, I think will still get better, but maybe he doesn't meet those expectations where he's legitimately, you know, contending a Heisman finalist type of thing. I think the other one is that the running back room is a much steeper drop off than we thought it was. I mean, I think it's going to not be as good when you don't have Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price back there. They're going to have to figure some things out, but maybe Aeneas Williams and Nolan James don't live up to what we think they can be in short yardage and still helping to move the change and things like that. So, and then I think one that we're still, you know, curious about is just what do they get at boundary receiver? And if that doesn't hit and it's relying too much on some smaller players and you don't have that go-to guy to one-on-one matchups, like I think all those things can maybe hold the offense back. I think it's hard to see the defense not living up to the hype, but there are certain ways where I think the offense still has some question marks there.
That's where I am. This is in no way predicting this. I'm not even going to list anything on defense. I'll be shocked. So realistically, living up to expectations is 12-0, 11-1. Everything about the offense, except for, other than C.J. Carr not being one of the top 4 quarterbacks in the country, I can't imagine he's not one of the top 10. Again, he will be that. You could name anything on offense like Drew did, some that the drop off at running back. We keep saying they'll be better at short yardage just because they weren't good at it last year at short yardage, and now they're better equipped for it with two low to the ground guys. Well, maybe they're not better in short yardage. Maybe like 2 years ago, they're not that good in, excuse me, not 2 years ago, maybe last, they're not that good in goal line situations. Remember how bad they were in goal to go situations? What if they're not better at that? They did lose two first round draft picks that were pretty darn good. And the guy at tight end, we all thought was going to catch five touchdowns inside the 10 yard line that caught zero. Anything on the offense is the reason they'll be below expectations. The defense, including the schedule, will not play below expectations this year, JB.
No, I completely agree. I don't think the defense plays below schedule. I also think it's, you can't answer this question without saying, well, you know, maybe BYU is that good. Maybe Darian Mensah makes people say Carson Beck who at Miami. Maybe Kevin Jennings has this transcendent breakout season for SMU. I don't think it's all variables that pertain to Notre Dame when you're answering a question like that. I think you have to look at the totality of it. And, you know, Notre Dame plays six games away from home. Is that right? I think. I'm pretty sure. Six games away from home.
Yes.
I don't believe, you can double check me, I don't think there's another team in any preseason top 10 ranking that plays six games away from home. So that to me is an important variable to consider.
The only thing I'll add to my point quickly too is I think if Carr is that top 10, top five quarterback, he can make up for the running backs underachieving or maybe not having the greatest boundary receiver situation. But if that happens and those other things happen, then it's hard to see Notre Dame's offense overcoming that to the point where they're, you know, making a deep run in the playoffs.
Our next question is from Kay Beasley. From counting down the Irish to NFL mock drafts and national writers, you all seem to be all over the place on who will emerge for Notre Dame at wide receiver. Seems to be the most unpredictable position group to predict snaps and production in the preseason compared to when. In other words, has there been a more promising position group with this level of uncertainty in a while? I like that last sentence. It's, we all believe there's talent in the wide receiver core. No one's universally pinpointing it.
Yeah, we don't know anything about Quincy Porter. We don't know really anything about Jaden Greathouse. We feel like we know a lot about Faison, and we continue to hear supremely great things about Mylon Graham. And there's a Logan Saldate, I think, could be in that group to be a slot guy that emerges. Certainly those younger guys, Finley Fitzgerald, Burris, can they take that next step? But yeah, there's candidates there. There's prospects, or as a coach once told me, finally, we've got prospects instead of suspects.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. And I think maybe at times it could be slightly rose colored that we look at it too, because I'm still thinking back to like 3 years ago where there are times where they had three or four healthy receivers and they just didn't have the depth. Now there's 15 guys running out there and there's a bunch of four-star prospects and guys who are, you know, former five stars and all that stuff. So I think it does just on paper look a little differently too, but I still think the upside's really high. Obviously I'm really bullish on what Jordan Faison can be this fall. And I think he adds a lot of value. So I'm curious. And in terms of historically, I wasn't covering the team at this time, but I do wonder, at least in terms of, I don't know where people were in 2018 before the season. I know Miles Boykin broke out that year. I know Chase Claypool had a lot of talent. I assume that was pretty evident on the beat. I'm guessing people didn't see it out of Chris Fink, but I assume at least based on what they achieved, I'm not sure that would have been predicted at the time, especially coming off of Brandon Wimbush season at starting quarterback too.
Yeah. Boykin had the Citrus Bowl. So the breakout game where everybody had to write in, change their MVP vote on the last second because of his catch and touchdown. And the whole offensive staff just kept saying Miles Boykin, Miles Boykin, Miles Boykin in his senior year. We all like Claypool, and the media loved Chris Fink, so we were happy to see him break out, and it happened pretty quickly. I was thinking back in 14, so Will Fuller was the breakout absolute star. I think everybody was looking at Corey Robinson as the star in the spring because he was so good as a freshman, and Jack Freeman's nodding. He remembers Corey Robinson one-on-one, taking everybody apart one-on-one. But Chris Brown was their number one returning receiver. He had 15 catches. In 16, bad year for receivers. 14 ended up being a good year. In 16, Torrey Hunter was the only guy coming back. We knew he was going to be good, but we knew Equanimeous St. Brown was going to be good that year. We were absolutely positive. And if he was on this team, he would easily be number two, if not number one. Equanimeous St. Brown. Like that was a talented player that ended up playing for a bad team. And then his next year, he ended up playing for a running team. So I go back to my Faison's the next indispensable guy. I just wouldn't be as high on the team if Faison wasn't there. And for some reason, he makes me higher on every wide receiver. I just think there's a trickle down that he's the best and then everybody else can fill in.
CJ Carr, I guess, helps with that too.
He does. CJ Carr makes the, we might not like the wide receivers if this was a situation where it was standard every day, very good quarterback. This is probably too good of a player to say, but Ian Book. If Ian Book was the quarterback, not a first round draft pick. Ian Book surprised me as a fourth round draft pick. Like, kudos to him that he did that. But no one looks at Ian Book as the same passer as CJ Carr. I would be a little less probably bullish on the passing game that I am with CJ Carr. Final question, kind of related. T-Row 1989. The buzz on tight end Ian Premmer is pretty exciting. It seems like any true freshman breakouts on ND generate a lot of buzz prior to the season. Of course, there is an exception to Michael Mayer because of COVID. Has there been an impact true freshman contributor, though, who truly surprised you with their performance? That is a really interesting question, because Kyle Hamilton, we heard all about Kyle Hamilton before that season started.
I mean, I still think Leonard Moore was a surprise, even if Benjamin Morrison kind of anointed him. Like, you still take those type of things with grains of salt, and to see him come out and do what he did and be one of the best corners in the country is still always going to be surprising.
I think for me, it's almost Benjamin Morrison. Like, I know he had generated buzz and all of that, but still, cornerback is arguably the hardest position to play as a true freshman in college football, especially in this era of college football. And he became a freshman All-American, if I'm not mistaken. So when I saw this question, he was an immediate thought. And frankly, Anthony Knapp is an immediate thought.
Heck yeah.
That's a good one. I mean,
come on. Like, this guy is supposed to be Tosh Baker, and they're going to piece it together and use Aeneas Williams or whoever to chip. And all of a sudden, Anthony Knapp's starting at Texas A&M, and you're winning the type of road game in the SEC that sets you on a path to eventually play for the national championship that year. So my three were Anthony Knapp, Benjamin Morrison, and then, frankly, Aeneas Williams, because, like, we knew and we saw that pass pro day that had Max Bulla going nuts. And I don't think we knew he would play that type of role in 2024.
All three of those are the best, are great. Knapp is off. I can't believe how good Anthony Knapp became as a freshman that year. That was ridiculous. Joe Alt's almost a default. Doesn't count. He was so good as a freshman when he took over midway through that season. So Alt would be one. Knapp would be the biggest surprise. Alt two. Going back, Notre Dame default started Kavari Russell at corner. In 2012, he was a high school running back who never played corner. He had played some safety. And he started because Lo Wood got hurt in August camp. And they had nothing else, nowhere else to turn. And he was a freshman All-American. So Kavari Russell is a freshman. Great job there. But I love this question because you almost always hear about how good the guys look. Kevin Sinclair heard about how good Leonard Moore looked. I remember that. We saw Benjamin Morrison. I've talked about this a lot. Clock Logan Diggs in a practice that was supposed to be thud. I immediately fell in love with Benjamin Morrison right there. I think Knapp and Kavari Russell, like, you were legitimately concerned about the position with Knapp and Kavari Russell. Like, that could have just been the end of the season for them both.
Yeah, I'm changing my answer to Knapp actually, too, because I mean, he's also a guy we thought was going to be a center when he came in. So right. The idea that he was going to start at left tackle a few months later, obviously it took an injury to Jagasaw to kind of open that spot. But still, that is not a guy I would have picked him to start at any of the other four positions along the offensive line before that one, too. He's obviously a freshman. I think his personality really stood out when he got on campus, but I didn't think of him as a guy who's going to be ready to play like that.
Basketball shout out, Pat Connaughton, friend of the show and a great all around person. Pat Connaughton as a freshman was amazing. Like, I could not believe how high that guy could jump. And yes, I said it that way because, you know, he's a gym rat and works really hard type of guy, but he could just apparently jump through the gym as well. JB, anyone from Tennessee?
I mean, you knew Eric Berry was going to be really freaking good, but I mean, that guy was like an All-American as a freshman, not just a freshman All-American. And yeah, I mean, I've said it before, like Kyle Hamilton and Eric Berry, blessed to have seen both those guys. They both were the number 14, to have seen the duration of their college careers. Pretty freaking incredible. So that's the first one. I mean, you could go back and there were some running backs that were different and special. And, you know, Darrell Barnett's a guy that stands out on the defensive line, just the type of body that and burst that Tennessee hadn't had for years until, you know,
winning that recruiting battle over Alabama, Georgia Tech, and some others. So those are the Tennessee guys that immediately come to mind.
All right, guys, that was fun. And we'll be back again for a little bit more fun next Monday, July 13th. And we'll also have a Thursday podcast, of course, that week. But I want to announce the Marcus Freeman interview will be 1 week later. So we may be adjusting a little bit. We'll at least have instant analysis. We're not sure of the timing or the format of that. But that is not next week. It is further into July. And we will catch you up on everything Marcus Freeman says on the record at that point. Until next week, for John Bryce of USA Today, Drew Medtock of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.